Welcome to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. It stands to reason that the sooner a disorder can be diagnosed, the sooner the treatment can begin. That's true of physical illnesses, and it's just as true for learning disabilities. Our first guest is a neuropsychologist who works with children, parents, and schools to diagnose children who have various learning problems and make sure they get the help they need. Dr. Karen Schultz is a neuropsychologist who teaches at the Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. She told Sound Medicine's Dr. Steve Bodwick that she urges parents to listen to their own instincts in deciding whether to seek a professional diagnosis for their child.
We all know that early intervention is everything to help these children, since many of a child's learning struggles will tend to worsen over time because they're getting older. In really testing every day for the past 27 years and listening to parents on a daily basis, you know, I get a lot of parents, their children would be 16, 18 years old, and they'll say to me, if only I would have trusted myself. Why didn't I move on what I needed, thought needed to be done when my child was 5 or 6? And it really is, that's the first step, is really to examine your own feelings and thoughts about your child's struggles. And there are three things a parent really needs to ask themselves in order to get themselves in the right direction. Because, you know, we all can have, for example, problems with attention and concentration. We all can have these areas. But there are three things that are important for a parent to keep in mind. Number one is frequency. You have to look at, is my child showing or, you know, and exhibiting these behaviors often? How often is it happening? Two, we have to look at intensity, or what we call severity in the field. How severe are the behaviors of your child comparing your child with other children at your child's age level? And, of course, this is all developmental. For example, we expect a 3 or 4-year-old to be inattentive. We expect for them to cry. We expect for them to have mood changes. But when a child's much older, we expect these behaviors to be managed more by the child because they're getting more and more mature. So you want to look at the intensity and severity of those behaviors. Number three is pervasiveness. The parents need to be alert, and they need to be their child's main advocate. I often call parents as the anchor point in helping a child. They're my eyes, and really understanding how pervasive is this child's difficulties. Are the difficulties showing up at home only, or, and are they showing up at school? Are they showing up when the child is taking tests, or in the classroom, or even during recess, during those more unstructured times, for example, such as lunchtime? So we want to see if the behaviors are occurring in many situations. So these are the three things that really help parents if you can keep in mind frequency, intensity, and pervasiveness, and knowing that if something's not quite right in your gut, something is a bit off, to really move on it, because you're probably right. You're probably right. Something isn't quite right. And that's when you really need to start with the pediatrician to get that ball rolling, to see, you know, if your hypothesis is right or not.
So you trust yourself, you trust your gut, you see issues of frequency, severity, pervasiveness, and then what kind of assessments would you move for in a situation where your gut told you something really had persisted and was severe enough over time?
First, we have to start with the pediatrician, because some of the difficulties that children can have can be cleared up by physical examination. It's just very, very important, and a real simple example is vision. Sometimes they get children in, you know, and they can't see the board, which means they can't really take notes very well from the board, and there may be missing notes in their assignment book and things like that, and the parents may be wondering, gee, is my child paying attention or not? Children are not accurate reporters as well, so they may not even know they have a vision problem. So the pediatrician is really the anchor point initially. And so a good physical examination needs to be done just to consider if there's anything else going on. Parents really need to be verbal with the physician. That's really important. The more information they give him or her, the better off the physician's going to be in really helping them determine the next step. And I gave an example of reading difficulties. If the doctor's here and the parent's bringing in, say, a 6 or 7-year-old, okay, and they know that there's been a family history of difficulties with reading, and if the parent indicates to them, you know, John had difficulty reciting nursery rhymes. He just wasn't into it, and I'm really concerned because he's forgetting the names of letters, and he's not understanding what a word is made out of. He can't understand, despite all that we do for him at home and the teachers are at school, that words can be broken down into syllables. And in kindergarten, around 5.5 to 6 years of age, children are already expected to decode, kind of, you know, read through simple words. So if a parent tells the physician and really gives the physician that information, that physician is probably going to refer for a psychological examination or a neuropsychological examination or even a psychoeducational evaluation to determine the extent of the reading difficulties. And in-depth testing then would be conducted to look at that. Now, on the other hand, not all children with reading difficulties have a reading disorder. I get a lot of kids in that will have reading comprehension problems, but, you know, they have difficulty with sustained attention. Reading takes time. So it's really important to have these assessments because the assessments will really help a parent understand their child's strengths and weaknesses. We'll see what the profile looks like as far as the weaknesses, and then we'll get the parents moving in the right direction concerning help. And, you know, we all have weaknesses. That's so clear with everybody, but it's the pattern of the weaknesses that the professionals look at.
If you're just joining us, this is Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Sound Medicine's Dr. Steve Bodgwick is talking with neuropsychologist Karen Schultz about her book, Beyond the Label.
Another example is social communication problems. What I mean by that are the kids and young adults who have a lot of problems making and keeping friends. They may have difficulties understanding facial expressions or the underlying intent of what people are really talking about. These are kids that all have problems keeping a friend for a while, okay? They may have interests, we call specialized interests. They may be into something to a great extent, like collecting things. They may be able to sit in front of a video game, like the Sims game, for 12, 15 hours a day and not interact with other peers or have friends that like that kind of thing too, that are into their interests. If a parent talks to a physician about that or tells them, you know, my child's very sensitive to foods and fabric and they don't like change, they get so upset if something happens during the day where it wasn't planned for. These are flags for the physician. And the physician's likely going to refer to a speech-language therapist because a speech-language therapist is also going to conduct an evaluation to really assess language in terms of social communication skills. You know, they're going to look at the child's organization of their language. They're going to look at, can they go back and forth in a conversation? Can they take turns when talking with other individuals? Do they look at that friend? Do they look at that adult when they're talking to them? Are they able to ask questions to the listener? Or are they just talking about what they want to talk about? These are all areas underlying making and keeping friends. So, for example, the speech-language pathologist then would be really critical to evaluate these areas with an in-depth testing, then recommending, if needed, treatment.
So the range is a bit startling. I mean, if you think about learning issues, speech, language, reading, social communication skills, difficulty with change. If an assessment is able to really target these, the next question then is, what about accommodating these challenges, these learning or behavior challenges. For instance, do you think that within the school systems that exist, there are ample opportunities for accommodating these challenges?
Yes, but it depends what type of school system you're talking about. There's private schools and there are public schools. My experience with private schools across the country, they're very, very supportive. They want to help the child. And they're very curious as far as how they can help the child. And it's important that the school be on the same page as the parents. You know, as a neuropsychologist, I work with school systems, I work with parents, and I work with medical professionals. So it's really a three-way process. We never test or treat a child in isolation. So we're always networking with the child's significant others in their life. In a public school system, there are certain laws. It's important to know that a child has a right to learn. A child has a right to access new learning in a classroom situation and has a right to access tests. If they are blocked, if they're jammed in their access, they are entitled to services, accommodations, and modifications. Because you can have a child with a reading difficulty who's very, very bright, but they have such difficult times reading, for example, quickly and automatically, that it'll stop them from completing a test on time. They'll need extended time, additional time, to complete the test. And the schools will implement accommodations and modifications, as well as special services such as reading programs, if the parent provides evidence that there is a disorder, a disability. And these are the two big areas that we can debate about, but you have to show a disorder and a disability. And what I mean by disability is a disability has to really significantly impact that child in the classroom environment and prevent them from learning or from taking a test. And the disability really speaks to the need that they're blocked, and it significantly needs to interfere with their ability to function at school. And it's targeted at the school and not in the home. Parents may have to go to several meetings at the school in order to provide evidence. The parents do have the burden of supplying the evidence to document their child's needs. And unfortunately, the meetings at schools aren't really focused on a child's strengths. They're really focused and targets the child's needs. If the disorder and disability qualifications are met within a public school district, then the child will be able to receive accommodations, modifications, or even specialized services in the school. So they can access the curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Schultz, if there was one particular thing that you would hope parents and educators have as a takeaway from your book, what would that be?
That's a good question. I love that question. I think the one thing would be aware of the warning signs. Don't deny it. Investigate it. That would be my takeaway from my book.
That's a very good one. Well, Dr. Karen Schultz, thank you so very much for being with us today on Sound Medicine.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Karen Schultz is a licensed psychologist in private practice and an associate professor at the Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. Her most recent book about diagnosing learning disabilities is Beyond the Label.